nine, eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. Well, good afternoon and welcome out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 or 92.3 FM, or maybe you might even be streaming. Who knows? None of my business. However you want to listen, that's fine with me. Hey, today I'm really excited about this. I get a one-on-one interview with Chris Jensen, which is good. We're going to talk about Theater on the Verge and their latest play, Torch Song. But also, I want to get caught up on Theater on the Verge and hear how things are going for you and all that stuff. So welcome, Chris. Welcome.
Thank you, Maeve. I'm glad to be here.
It's so good to have you. So good to have you. So let's hit it a little bit first on Torch Song. You guys, what made you decide to do this play? You came off of your first run, and then you went into this. And was that a tough decision? How did you come about that?
Torch Song was actually going to be the first play that we were going to take on. We had the rights to it last fall.
Okay.
And we were going to start with this one.
Okay.
And then we found Every Brilliant Thing, yeah, which I think we realized in retrospect wisely that starting with something a little smaller scale, that was a one-person show.
Yeah.
Would allow us to just kind of test this thing out. Yeah. I'm really glad we did that, because while Torch Song has been an incredibly rewarding experience, audiences have loved it. I enjoy watching it. It was a far more challenging piece to put together, just in terms of, you know, it has a full set. It has set changes, just the logistical elements.
Well, and the more than one actor.
And six actors. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just have thought so many times, I'm glad we didn't start with this one, that this has been kind of our step up. You know?
And that space at Hamilton worked out so beautifully for Every Brilliant Thing. I just thought that was just so lovely, especially with the audience participation and all that. Has it been a little more challenging to stage this?
Certainly more challenging. And there were times where I was honestly like, I don't know that this is going to work.
Yeah.
But I'm not always as good at visualizing those elements.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I really lean on Troy, our director, and our set designer, Jeremy Whittington. My brain doesn't always think that way. Sometimes I get caught up on what seems to be problems and I can't find the solution, and they kind of help me see the solution. But Torch Song has been enormously rewarding, in part because it's a play that for both Troy and I has kind of been in our heads for a long time.
Okay.
It's something we both encountered, I think, about 30, 35 years ago when we were younger, and also just kind of coming out, you know?
Yeah.
And when I discovered Torch Song through the movie, there was a movie version of Torch Song Trilogy back in 1988. A friend of mine brought it over to show it to me shortly after I came out my freshman year in college. He said, I think you need to watch this. And it really, it knocked me sideways, because I had never, I think all the other gay stories or gay-centered stories I'd seen up to that point were about HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
They are important stories, and I'm glad but when I was 18, that wasn't my story. I didn't really relate to that. Right. And so here was a story about a guy who's just trying to figure out his place in the world, and who has this out and out battle with his mother in the third act, in the third section, that laid me flat, you know, in part because I was going through some of that with my own parents.
Right.
And having those really hard conversations and people saying things that they think are helpful.
Right.
They're not necessarily helpful.
Yeah, people get kind of awkward around it.
Yeah.
And I remember having somebody say to me, I'm really afraid if I say something, you I might offend you.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, I think I'm still the same person. It doesn't take offense very much.
Right.
But so that would have been like 1982 is when that
The play came out in 1982, where the play was first written in the late 70s as three separate plays. Then it was brought together into a 1 4-hour night of entertainment as Torch Song Trilogy. That went to Broadway in 1982, won a couple Tony Awards in 1983.
Okay.
The movie came out in 1988.
Okay.
I discovered it in the mid-90s.
Okay, so this version that you're doing, is it sort of an amalgamation of scenes from all three of the trilogy, and then kind of
Harvey Fierstein, I think he in 2018 he went back and cut it back into a 2-hour two act play that it contains really all of the, I think, all the scenes and elements that most people who know the original would remember. It just streamlines it and makes it far more producible.
Oh, yeah.
It's part of the reason why this has never been produced in Spokane is because for most of its life, it was a 4-hour play.
So how long has this been, this iteration been out?
Since for 7 years now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that must have been really difficult for him. He got this baby and you're just going to chop it up.
Yes. Although I think it just in practical terms, you know, if you're going to be able to expose more people to it and I think that, and also, I think the harder part may have been, I don't know, I don't live in Harvey Fierstein's head, but to have a part that is so associated with him, because he starred in it, he wrote it and starred in it, it was his big kind of coming out in a lot of ways, and to hand that off to another actor, to a younger actor, in this case it was Michael Urie, who took that role on, and that would, I imagine, be very difficult. Something that is just so much your own voice and that you created over a series of years and is so associated with you. And Harvey Fierstein's voice, like everything about him is so distinctive,
yes,
right?
So I was going to say, people who don't think that they know him, if we played
as
it
as he
him,
talks,
they,
you know, yeah.
They would know, kind of like a Gilbert Gottfried, type of, I know that person from The Voice.
Yeah. And that was another thing I was concerned about with our production is like, how do we find someone who can kind of make this role their own?
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm now grateful for is that the contract for this show stipulated that we had to cast someone who was no older than 35.
Oh, perfect.
And we cast this actor, Jonah Taylor, remarkable local actor who has never seen the film version. And we made sure that stayed that he has not seen it.
Yeah.
And he was able to just make it his own.
Because I think as an actor, if you're playing somebody, that's real, sometimes you can go like, well, am I going to do an impression of this person?
Right.
Or do I do my own take on it? Do I look at this person and say, okay, this is what I pick up from him or her, and then I'm going to, you know, let that bubble inside of me and then come up with something new.
Right, and there's some freedom here because it is semi-autobiographical. The character is Arnold Beckoff, who I think resembles in many ways Harvey Fierstein, but we don't have to somehow recreate Harvey Fierstein, the person. Fortunately, he can just make his own version of Arnold Beckoff as he sees it through the text rather than trying to see it through this other performance.
Well, and the mother in the original is such a hard case.
Yeah.
She's just so hard.
Yeah.
And I just think, what's the chemistry like between those two?
Oh man. So Marianne McLaughlin is the actress playing Ma. And, this is her first time acting in, I think about 10 years.
Yeah. I remember her from, I want to say Interplayers Ensemble.
Yeah. She's a fantastic actress. And when we were trying to figure out our second piece to take on, Troy was really intent on finding a vehicle for Marianne. And that's where we started. We're like, Torch Song, let's go back to Torch Song because we knew it had a great part for her.
Yeah.
And so we started there and then we built out the cast from there. And from the very first read through with those two, I was like, yeah, we can just take these. I mean, as soon as they get it memorized, we're good to go. Like this is just the... And their accents are very well matched. They kind of look like they could be mother and son. And that scene, especially there's this really knockdown, drag out fight they have every night in the theater. Like the theater just gets silent. Like, wow. You could just feel, you can feel it when that happens, that sense where, yeah, everything's almost suspended, yeah, you know, and you're just there with them.
Well, those are those moments, and Troy's so good at that, of being like, okay, this is one of the funny parts. You need to make it super funny because then we're going to sink people
right
after this.
Right. He really, and to allow those moments to land.
Yeah.
You know, and to let the audience kind of catch up with you and inject, you know, really take in what's just happened. And one of the things I've enjoyed too, because we watch every performance, is hearing the gasps from, yeah, the audience at the things that the mother says, because there, some of them are, at one point she says, if I'd known you were going to be gay, I wouldn't have bothered having you.
Wow.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of people who've heard something, yeah, like that from their parents.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of other people who have no idea that those kinds of words are spoken still, yeah, even today.
Yeah.
And how incredibly hurtful that is. And yet, she is one of the things I love about the character and about this performance, and that I really relate to in my own relationship with my parents, is that despite all of these sometimes missteps and despite the hurtful, harmful things that may have been done over the years, it is absolutely clear that they love each other.
Yeah.
And that, you know, she's sometimes very clumsy. She's sometimes causes a great deal of pain.
Yeah.
But there is still some love there, and she is in her way trying to, yeah, find, you know, to find some connection. And, yeah, and one of the things too, that struck me about Torch Song, and that's maybe, it's a little depressing how relevant it still is.
Yeah.
You know, this is a play that was written in the late 70s.
Right. Especially with the drag, because, mm-hmm, the protagonist, makes his living as a drag performer.
Right, yeah, right. And I mean, I was saying to Troy, in part because drag is so much more mainstream now than it was at the time,
right,
because of things like RuPaul's Drag Race, it has also become much more of a target. It's become, yeah, much more visible and is seen as a threat to children and all these other things that, that these talking points on the right. And so I thought, you know, in some ways, drag is almost more controversial now than it was in the 70s because it's so much more front and center.
Yeah, it's sort of like in a different way, more controversial or more, right, dangerous to them, I kind of feel like. And I think the hard part right now for us in the LGBT community is, you know, seeing people who are good people, who would have been allies or maybe just neutral people, siding with the perpetrator, siding with the people who will harm other people,
right,
because they're afraid.
Right.
They're afraid that they're going to be sued. They're afraid they're going to be shut down. And that wasn't what it was in the past. I mean, it was like, I think it was funny because when these corporations dipped their toes into like, oh, let's do Pride Month stuff at Target. Right. You know, we really care, but we'll sell more stuff. And everybody's like, Target's the best. And they love them for it.
Right.
And then, you know, that was kind of, people were, I think, kind of surprised by that. But now they've gone in this opposite direction. So, yeah, you know, I think during Trump's first presidency, to do a drag queen story hour was sort of like, ah, not a big deal. But now I don't know what the comfort level of doing that at the library would be. I don't know if that would be something that would happen.
Right. Right. I mean, I know that just in our ticketing page, I was very clear that children under the age of 17 will not be admitted to the show without a parental, like some kind of guardian or supervisor. Yeah. There is a scene that's a very frank, like a depiction of sex, which is part of the reason why I put that in there. But I also did have some concerns about, you know, I just, in the current climate, I felt like I wanted to make it clear that this, yeah, is not necessarily meant for kids, but, you know, it might be something that thoughtful parents might want to bring their kids to and talk about afterward.
You know, that's so funny because I think that was that in my mind when you were saying that, that's what I was just picturing, a kid going with his parents. And then, you know, maybe that child isn't gay, but then just to know that parent is accepting of people, right, and modeling, right, modeling behaviors of love.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and we have, yeah, seen that. We have seen some families come to the show, and that's been really lovely to see.
That's cool.
But I think just in terms of sort of protecting ourselves,
yeah,
I put that in there.
Yeah, that's, know, a good point. When I came out to my mom, I was like, hey, my mom was talking to me on the phone. She said, you know, your Aunt Evie, she was such a good person. She took in a man who his family kicked him out because he was gay and he had AIDS, and his family kicked him out of his home, and she took him in. Can you believe that somebody would do that to a family member? My mom saying this. Yeah. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, that must be pretty hard for a parent here. I said, would you, if you wanted to hear that from your child, that they were queer in some way, would you want to be told in person or would you want to be told over the phone? And she said, you know, I think I'd like to be told in person. And I said, I'll be over in 20 minutes. And yeah. then I went, and then we weren't able to do it because other people came over. But it was like, but still, when I told her, she was so surprised anyways, even though right. I thought I was greasing the skids. So you, it sounds like you sort of had, with your family, when you came out, you sort of had, not maybe horrific, but it was tough.
It was tough, you know, and they, at one point, they induced me to go to ex-gay therapy.
What's that like?
Well, in my case, it was linked to the fact that they were helping me with college at that time.
Yeah.
And so they basically said, in order, if they were going to keep doing that, then I needed to pursue this. It was called Exodus International.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, Exodus, right? Yeah.
So they, we found this... We found this person at a local university, a university near where I went to college, who was a member of Exodus International, or rather had was attached to the organization. He was recommended to us because he was a musical theater professor.
Okay.
And so...
Well, you could write the rest of the story.
And the jokes write themselves. So I remember going and sitting in like the little lobby outside his office, and there were like these Sondheim posters, and I was like, what is happening?
Yeah.
And he was a lovely man. He was a lovely man. I could have been paired up with someone who might have given me a very different experience.
Right.
But in his case, as soon as he figured out that I was not there, that I was basically being forced to go if I wanted to keep going to college.
Right.
As soon as he figured that out, he said, look, I've kind of found my own path here, and this is what I am comfortable with, but I have no intention of forcing you down wow. any path. And he said, if you want, I can tell your parents what they want to hear, and I'll give you voice lessons where you can just come here and...
Wow.
So, yeah.
That sounds like a play right there.
Yeah, yeah, it was lovely. That, yeah.
That's a wonderful story.
And, you know, and he was at the time married to a woman, and I did not, and he was, no, it was a real gift that could have been such a traumatic experience. And it was in some ways, you yeah. know, then to have landed in a safe place with someone who was had no desire to yeah. make me into something that I didn't want to be.
Wow, that's lovely.
Yeah. And you know, I actually looked him up on Facebook not long ago for the first time in many years, and he's married to a man now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he, you know, he was just on his path.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of respect for that. But his path was his own.
Well, and yeah. I also think, you know, when as far as people in our lives, for me, you know, it was like they knew me as John and they knew me as this guy and all this stuff. And I was taking that away from them.
Right.
I had a lot of empathy for them. And I always think that when we get to tell the truth about ourselves, that gives us a kind of a strength.
Yes.
And so, you know, as much as people can hurt us, it's like I don't endorse that, but I will try to be with you in this, you know, and try to help you through it. You know?
Right.
Yeah. So we should probably talk before we get too far in the weeds here. We should probably tell people how they can get tickets and when the sure. show is showing and where it's showing and all that good stuff.
Sure. So Torch Song is playing for one more weekend in the Listening Room at Hamilton Studio, which is in the West Central neighborhood. Show times are on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 7:30 p.m. You can get tickets at www.theateronthetheverge.com. That's theater with an E-R on theverge.com. We're also on Facebook.
Yeah. And that is such a lovely space. It's an old gymnasium that's mm-hmm. been converted to, it's like a long time ago, got converted to a studio, photography yeah. studio, and then music and everything else.
Yeah, and it's like in a 30-foot cyclorama, which is a sort of, it's almost like this floating space. And so we have yeah. a set this time, these series of platforms that Jeremy Whittington designed for us, but the platforms just sort of float, you okay. know, in this, it's a really, it's an unconventional space that really lends itself to, I think, that kind of dream space of good theater.
Okay, yeah.
It's been interesting working with it in such a different way this time.
Yeah, and then you have actors. You don't have wings, so you have actors just going to step in. And
we do. I mean, they have sort of wings.
Yeah.
they are very tight wings. They're very okay. small wings, but the actors can step off. And working all that out was one of the harder parts.
Yeah,
though, figuring out how to do not just set changes, but like how to get Jonah out of his makeup for the next scene. Like, where does he do that? And,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
like all those questions.
Yeah.
That we managed to work out, but we were up until, you know, final dress still trying to solve. It was at times it really felt like we were flying by the seat of our pants, but I think partly because Troy has so much experience and such good instincts.
Yeah.
And even though he maybe wasn't always sure where we were going, I think we trusted the process.
Yeah. And it was in good hands. That space, I think the cyclorama, do you use that at all in the,
not
all?
Really.
Yeah,
it just,
sometimes
but,
you can put slides on it and stuff
well,
like
well,
that.
We do. Actually, we have yeah. slides at the beginning of each section that sort of contextualize.
Okay.
One of the slideshows is around like drag queens from the 70s. In 60s and before even. Another is about, is focused on pictures of sort of pre-Stonewall LGBT couples.
Okay.
And then the last one is focused on protest and resistance.
Okay. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So. Did you consult with drag queens in doing this at all? Or did you feel comfortable with enough knowledge of
We didn't necessarily. I mean, Troy has done a fair amount of work, helping people put their faces on.
Yeah, the makeup's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I was able to sit and watch Troy put Jonah's face on for the first time,
yeah.
which was kind of lovely, and seeing that transformation take place
yeah.
and seeing how that then changed Jonah's physical performance is very interesting.
Yeah.
How I think freeing that can be. You know,
yeah,
and a lot of things clicked into place when Jonah got into drag for the first time. In terms of, and there's a lovely line near the beginning of the play where Arnold, his character, says, you know, I don't want a man for this part of me. He motions to himself in drag. He says, I want him for the other part, the part that isn't so well protected.
Wow!
Yeah.
Wow, that's yeah. heavy. I always people haven't seen me, and they know that, you know, I'm trans now, and then when they meet me after I've transitioned a few years ago, I felt like they kind of felt like a little let down because they were expecting more of a drag queen type of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would just
yeah.
say, you know, I said I was trans. I didn't say I was very good at it. because I think, you know, it's like those things I have, like makeup and all that. It's like, it fascinates me. I'm not very good at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to have a master like Troy doing that, because I mean, yeah, the pictures are just incredible.
Yeah. When we, unfortunately, working with Don Hamilton, he's been taking those photos for us. And really, I mean, that man, he can... The way he sets up shots and just finds these, and there's really rich colors in that space that you can project onto the cyclorama to have these backdrops, and he created some just luscious images for us.
And you know, he's such a pillar of the community too.
I know.
He just is a guy that makes things happen for good things in Spokane all over the place.
They have been so generous to us in terms of just. Really along for the ride. And you know, we have just taken over that space. And I was nervous about that, and because I don't want to damage that relationship, you know. I want to, and it has only strengthened it. And actually, I think it's made Don really excited about this prospect of having, say, platforms for live music in there, because it just creates better sight lines. It's been a really wonderful partnership. They're so supportive, and they just helped us put together this really nice video interview of Troy that we just posted today. That's shot by Don Hamilton. You know that I could not even begin to shoot something that beautiful.
I haven't seen it yet. I'll have to take a look at that. Yeah. Now Troy, of course, is a director, and you're the producer. Mm-hmm. Now, for those people who are not familiar with theater too much, maybe they know the producers,
right?
You know, Springtime for Hitler in Germany, and all that. But what I think maybe a role of producer shifts in different times. But what have you found yourself being primarily concerned with as a producer?
So for me, a lot of it comes down to, the classic role of the producer, say like on Broadway, if someone is a producer, they're essentially writing the checks.
Yeah.
And I do that. I could sort of oversee the money side of things. That makes me sound like some kind of high roller. I'm not. You know, we have a very simple setup where each show is designed to pay for the next one. And fortunately, we're self-sustaining in that way. And that's working out well. But I sort of handle just the business side of things and the marketing side of things. And that includes getting the rights to the show, doing all that kind of behind the scenes stuff, just so that we can actually put the show on.
But
I was also the morning of final dress rehearsal, running around to all the antique stores trying to find, you know, like a screen that we could use on the stage. There's like a folding screen.
Right.
So my role was, both Troy and I are wearing multiple hats, and he does some things that some people may say that sounds almost like a producer. But I think largely speaking, he's focused on like the aesthetic of the show and just getting all those elements in place so it feels of a piece. And I'm more in sort of a, I guess, support role from a financial and marketing perspective.
Okay. Now, how long has Theater on the Verge been around now?
We just started in October.
Okay. So not even a year yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is your second show. So what, do you feel, are some things kind of surprised you? You know, starting a theater company like that?
So a few things. I mean, I think one of the things that I like is that we don't have our devoted brick and mortar space. You know, we rent, which gives us a lot of freedom, you know. And right now we are really very happy with the Hamilton studio space. We love that collaboration. You know, there may be something that comes along here where we feel like it would be better suited in another space, in which case we'll look into that. But we were looking at other spaces, and we just found that because Don Hamilton knows theater. He started off as a lighting designer at a theater down in the Central Coast of California. There were so many things that we just didn't have to explain to him. He just gets it. I think that element of man, I've completely lost my train of thought.
I was just asking what might have surprised you.
What did surprise me? One of them was, one thing I didn't really think about was, because we don't have our own brick and mortar space, rehearsal space.
I was going to ask you about rehearsal
space. Was at first kind of like a, wait, how do we solve this? We can't just do that. This is in my living room, you know? Yeah. And so we've now pretty much solved that. We have a nice studio space that we rent up on the north side that's really well suited to at least early rehearsals.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cost a lot of money. We've also found a church here locally that has a nice like basement room
that's
very, very inexpensive. But that's been, I think, the hardest thing to figure out.
I was going to ask you about that, because having been a member of so many groups that have like come and gone and come and gone.
Right.
You know, myself, it's like you wind up like, okay, rehearsal this week's going to be at this library, and then we're going to move to this outdoor space. Then we're going to be in, you know, somebody's garage.
Oh, yeah.
And then maybe you can get in there, hopefully right before tech, get in there and start nailing some stuff down. But yeah, it's rehearsal. I think if somebody was thinking about starting a business, just a rehearsal space, you know, just a big right. space that people could tape off, you know, say this is the dimensions and this is where this is going to be and just work on your stuff would be a great thing.
Yeah. I think this, you know, this studio that we rent, it's just a kind of a collective where people just, we have a shared calendar and you claim your spot in the calendar.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Then everybody throws in a little bit of cash at the beginning of the month.
So oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's cool. Well, so have you thought, have things sort of like you've got your legs under you now pretty well. Are you starting to kind of dream about doing things in a different way? I wouldn't say bigger or better, but... or what, you know,
so I will say that our next show is I think we're pushing out in different directions here. So, right. We started very, very simple with Every Brilliant Thing. We've now done a show with multiple characters and set change, like a full set. Our next one is, we're not announcing it for a week, but It's a musical.
I was going to say that's the next evolutionary step. It's a musical.
But it's a musical that's extremely well suited to that space because it's a two-person musical.
Okay.
And the orchestration is for piano and cello, which I love. I just love.
Lovely.
It's a lovely combination. And the musical is so gorgeous. It's so moving. It really also, I was saying to Troy earlier today, you know, we didn't plan it this way, but I think someone could look at the first three shows we're doing and say, okay, these guys are working out some mommy issues because they're all three of them deal right. very much with like with complicated relationships with mothers.
Yes, you're right.
And this one all, very much too. And I think that's part of what interests us though about these pieces is that they actually, you know, they're entertaining, they're funny, they're beautiful, but they really have some depth to them.
Yeah.
And they're exploring some of the messier and harder sides of these relationships that I think at this stage in our lives we find really interesting.
Yeah.
And we want to be asking these questions and looking more closely at the people who created us, who brought us here. You know what I mean?
Right. And it's a commonality that we all have. In right. theater, you know, right. we all have parents of some
yeah. everybody has way. A mother. What is that from? Anyway, yeah. So yeah.
And it seems like this character, the main character of the play, I find it so heartening because he just wants to have a life.
Yeah.
It's not fighting a life or death thing.
Right.
He just wants to have a life. And that's something that most people just sort of take for granted. I mean, you know, watch the Flintstones and they go to the Order of Royal Buffaloes on Wednesday night. You know, people have lives, but sometimes, especially back then, LGBT folks, I mean, it was really hard to have a life.
Right. There's one point where Arnold says, you know, in reference to his mother, he says, I wish you could understand that all I want is everything that she had.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he says to her directly later, he says, you know, I've taught myself how to do all these things, how to cook and do taxes, and I can pat myself on the back. But so I don't have to ask anybody for anything, all I want is love and respect. Wow. And, you know, at that time for a play, I mean, I think it's hard to overstate how remarkable it was that this play, this four-hour play, went to Broadway in 1982 that was centered around a gay character who wasn't punished for being gay.
Yeah.
You know, most of the other examples of that, you have, say, like Lillian Hellman's The Children's Hour, which is about a relationship between two women where the play concludes by one of them hanging herself. That's the end of the play, which when that play was written, I think was seen as a somewhat compassionate ending. Like, oh, look at these poor, poor ladies. Like, oh my God.
Although they're united in death.
That's right. Poor Audrey Hepburn. Yeah. But I just, you know, but the sort of, the feeling that gives across is that this is almost what these people deserve.
Yeah.
You know, this is, they are punished. It's in almost like a Dante-esque sort of way. It's like, you know, you're going to be punished in a manner suited to, you know, your sin.
Yeah.
And here with Torch Song Trilogy, Harvey Fierstein created a character who just, he's choosing life and he's choosing joy and he's trying to walk toward the light.
Yeah.
And even though he's up against it in some ways, especially with the kind of mother telling him the things that she's telling him,
right.
but he just keeps saying, no, I deserve to I deserve dignity and love and respect.
Yeah. And he wants, not to give the plot away too much, but has a boyfriend in the thing, and that kind of doesn't end well. And, things that people could recognize. And But yeah, it's just, and I think looking at the cast list, people will recognize some of these folks from other plays.
Yeah. And it's part of one of the threads throughout the show is his relationship with this bisexual guy named Ed, who goes off and marries a woman, and then in the final section of the play, it seems like they might be drifting back toward each other. But I think that's one of the other things that's lovely about this piece is it allows its characters to grow.
Yeah.
And because it traces them over a 5-year period. And the Ed that we meet at the beginning is very different from the Ed that we meet at the end. And he's starting to realize that trying to shape himself into what his family and society wants him to be, or he thinks his family and society wants him to be, is not working.
Yeah.
And it's just making him deeply unhappy, and that what he really wants is to be with a person who makes him feel like himself.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because there was, you know, if you look back, like maybe a couple of years ago, there was so much good news about LGBT folks in the, in the newspaper and things like that, that I think people might have said, God, there's just always something about trans people or gay people in the paper. And now I'm channeling somebody I know, but now, you know, it's sort of like, it's gotten quiet. Mm-hmm. There's not as much stuff in the paper, but at the same time, I think you start to see more protests and things like that. And I remember having an argument with somebody back in the 80s about somebody who was really against, you know, marriage equality, which wasn't called that then. It was same-sex marriage.
Right, right.
And so, and it was like, oh, the gays want this and the gays want that and blah, blah, blah. It's all we hear about. And I just said to him, I go, well, you know, if it was in your power to just give that to them, you would never have to hear from them again.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, in a way, this current administration is kind of pushing us more back into militancy, which I don't know if that's good, but, you know, it's an automatic response.
Right.
When you're under attack.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that is interesting looking at Torch Song 2 is that, or Torch Song Trilogy, this character that Harvey Weinstein creates wants things that are very traditional in many ways.
Yeah.
You know, he wants a child, he wants a husband, and things that in 1978, 1980 were radical because they were so traditional, because they were so associated with something that many LGBT folk didn't even bother to dream about.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that even, so I grew up, you know, I was coming out in the 90s, and at that point, I'm 48, and as a teenager, the idea of getting married, like it just didn't even, it really wasn't on my radar at all, because it wasn't an option. Like, why would I even think about that? And I remember I happened to be in San Francisco back in 2004, that weekend when Gavin Newsom allowed all the gay couples to marry, and they lined up around City Hall, and there was all this fretting about, oh my gosh, this is going to lose us the election in 2004, you know, because, but I remember I was with my boyfriend and we just were walking around City Hall and, just almost in a daze, because it was like, first of all, it was just a bunch of really, it was so much joy. Right? Like it was, and, but it was this sense of how it just felt so unreal. And also, I think part of me didn't care if it affected the election, because I just, it felt like such a window into what could be.
Yeah.
And how daring it was to just say, no, we're going to do this thing. You can stop us if you want to, but, how powerful that was for me. And I was in my mid-20s, you know, late 20s. Yeah. And that wasn't that long ago.
No.
You know, it really wasn't. And for such a profound shift to happen within those next few years when I was living in the Bay Area, and to see so many of my friends get married, and now, so the thing that I never thought could be mine suddenly started to feel like it was just part of the fabric of, you know, the world I lived in. Yeah. And now it feels as if that thing that I've now started to take for granted is in a more perilous space. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but sometimes when you have that, when you get something that you should have been able to have all along,
right,
that there is a sense of loss,
right,
that wasn't on your screen ever,
right,
that wasn't a possibility, that you know, to be able to live your life in the way you want, and then to say, oh, I should have had this.
Yeah,
this was wrong that I didn't have this. I remember having beers with a couple of women who were firefighters, friends of mine, and one of them said, "Well, you knew, how long did you know that?" I knew probably since I was five that there was something up. I couldn't put a name to it. And I said, "But you know what? I think that it really made me look at people more and empathize with people more, and I think it made me better at my job, and it made me a better person in a lot of ways because I tried to fight this," and this other gal said, "I think that's the stupidest and saddest thing I've ever heard." And she was right, because, you know, I think we kind of, this will build character. And while, you know, there's other people that don't think twice about how they can live their lives.
Right. And that sense of almost like vigilance that you develop, because... You
always,
know, always vigilant.
Plan A, plan B.
Right,
this
right,
happens.
Exactly.
This, yeah.
Can be useful, yeah. Yes, in some ways, but it's heartbreaking that you become, I'll speak for myself, that I had to become so adept at playing some role.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And, yeah, no, I mean, it is, but I do think that there is a way in which all of that experience has made me more empathetic.
Yeah.
It has made me more, over time, if I allow it to be.
Yeah.
That pain, what is it? Pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress, which is, unfortunately, I think is true.
Yeah.
I'd like to have the pain-free version sometime, but that seems to be what,
yeah,
you know, what really causes me to grow is to walk through those. Really.
Well, you examine things that maybe other people wouldn't have thought twice about.
Well,
why don't we tell people one more time how they can see the play, and then I'm going to do my 20-minute to the hour stuff.
Yeah, sure. So Torch Song is plays for one more weekend in the listening room at Hamilton Studio in the West Central neighborhood. The address is 1427 West Dean. It's on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings at 7:30 p.m. You can get tickets at www.theaterontheverge.com. That's theater with an E-R on theverge.com.
All right. And we'll be right back. Support for Out and About comes from the nonprofit Unitarian Universalist Church of Spokane, a liberal religious community supporting ideals of social justice, environmental stewardship, and freedom of thought for persons of all ages, races, ethnicities, and sexual preferences. The church offers two Sunday services as well as children and youth programs. Information is at uuspokane.org or by calling 509-325-6383.
Support for Out and About comes from Eastern Washington University Running Start, where high school students can earn tuition-free credit before graduating. Applications at ewu.edu/runningstart.
Out and About receives support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods. Located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street in Spokane. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com.
Support for Out and About comes from the nonprofit Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture in Spokane. Now presenting Preston Singletary, Raven and the Box of Daylight, bringing the Tlingit creation story to life. And Fire, Rebirth and Resilience, exploring our region's major fires from the Great Fire of 1889 to today. More information at northwestmuseum.org.
Americana Avenue receives support from Crazy Train Eatery in Spokane. Located at 5016 North Market Street, Crazy Train offers meals made with locally sourced ingredients. More information is available at 509-473-9031 and at thegrainshed.coop/crazy-train-eatery.
The Spokane Permaculture Symposium will take place at Shadle Park Library on Saturday, August 16, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Sunday, August 17, from noon to 4 p.m. The event features lightning presentations, breakout sessions, roundtable discussions, and opportunities for networking. It's open to the public. Information online at SpokanePermaculture.org.
Okay. You are listening to Out and About on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, and I am your host, Maeve, and I'm talking to my friend Chris Jensen, and we are talking about Theater on the Verge's production of Torch Song. I don't know why I spaced it out. We've been talking about it the entire time, but it sounds so... It sounds like such a lovely production. And you kind of talked a little bit about the audience. Mm-hmm. Do you find like the audience is a little bit different each night, or did things hit about in the same places?
It is interesting how people react differently. I mean, it's a comedy drama. It seems like some nights the audience is more attuned to one or the other.
Yeah.
I think consistently... It's always very clear that the audience is still with us by the time we get to that mother scene, because the gasping that happens is so, they're just in it, yeah. You know? But, I think there is an undercurrent of sadness that runs through much of the play.
Yeah.
Even though there's a lot of really great one-liners, it's very quippy. It's written at times almost like with this sitcom sort of verve, but, Arnold at times is a little heartbreaking, yeah, with his character. And I think some audiences are more attuned to that and respond more to that and are less inclined to laugh uproariously because of that undercurrent of sadness.
Yeah. And, you know, and not to put too fine a point on it, but I think that what you and Troy have put together in the cast and everybody is that this is kind of the stuff we need right now.
Yeah.
This is... I think these are really dark times for a lot of people. I mean, I was listening to a medical professional, and he was talking about that, not just, you know, we talk about like people's medical care being taken away and being more difficult to get and all that, but just that the losses people are facing at seeing what the country has become, of the loss of democracy, loss of institutions, and mm-hmm. all that, that a theater is such a strong institution that's been there providing people comfort for so long. And I just think that what you guys are doing is such a wonderful gift to everybody.
Well, thank you. It's a gift to ourselves too, to be able to... Yeah, there may be something really narcissistic about this. I'm not sure. It is theater. But, you know, yeah. I think part of the way we think about it is that if we do things that connect with us, that we feel personal passionate about, that yeah. we can trust that there will be people out there who feel connected to it as well, who feel that, who connect to that sense of passion. And there's a line from a musical I really love that says, "I'd rather be 9 people's favorite thing than 100 people's 9th favorite thing."
Oh.
And that's very much how I want to do. You know, like, I don't want to have a bunch of people say like, "Oh, that was okay." I want like yeah. a few people to say that was great. And I love that. It's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's understandable.
You know? And, I think that's kind of what we're going for. And I feel like we're connecting with the people who see what we're doing and value it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also, you're also, even though it is a work of fiction,
it is telling a truth that a lot of people have lived this truth,
yeah.
you know, of dealing with parents and dealing with love and loss. And in a time where truth seems to be kind of in short supply,
yeah.
Every place you look, that it's great to have a story that kind of, I don't want to say upholds traditional values, but in a way it is. I mean, this thing about honor and being a good person and just wanting to live your life and just be a human is yeah. something that we kind of took for granted before,
yeah.
But it's slipping away.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the heartening things is seeing something that I connected to so powerfully 30 years ago when I first came across it, seeing it connect so powerfully with people in the audience. I mean,
yeah.
people are almost speechless after the show in yeah. terms of they'll come up to us and they're so, and these are, you know, straight people, LGBT folk, like all manner of people, all ages. They're many of the audience members really seem to be connecting with it in a powerful way, which to me, that's what good theater is about. It's yeah. about connection.
And you talk about it afterwards.
Yeah.
And it
yeah. And it's, that, but it's that sense of like, this is only happening just like this, just this once, you know, and tomorrow night will be different. In fact, Harvey Fierstein's autobiography is called I Was Better Last Night, which I think is a great title yes. for an actor. It's yeah. a great bathroom book. It's like, it's very dishy and it's these short little chapters. It's yeah. it's wonderful. And if you're interested in Torch Song Trilogy, he has a whole section in there about how he went about writing it.
Wow.
But I love that. It really feels like we're connecting. And I think that's what I need more than anything right now is because I, yeah. if I get myself into, if I'm doom scrolling all alone on my phone, I can go to a very dark place.
Yeah.
And I have to get out there and stay connected with my people and find other people who...
Have you,
yeah.
Watching the performers do this every night. Have you watched kind of an evolution in their performances as they've kind of gotten, I don't know, got to live this with an audience and with themselves?
Yes. One thing that's been lovely is that, you know, this cast, they've really bonded and everyone is so nice. Like it's yeah. just this very kind group of people. We haven't had any diva fits. We haven't had any of this. All the drama has been where it belongs on the stage.
Good.
And, that's a really lovely experience and not always the case, you know?
Yeah.
And, it just feels like, and they've really gone along with us in, you know, on this tightrope kind of thing, trying to figure this out, trying to build a car as it's in motion sort of. And, you know, everyone has been very flexible and patient with this and has trusted the process. But I've seen them, you know, as the audience reacts, and that's always lovely to see, especially in a comedy when you get actors in front of an audience, you
yes.
kind of see them come to life a little bit and sort of realize,
hey,
you know, yeah this is, hey, yeah, look at this.
Feels good.
And, you know it's been, there's so much warmth among the cast right now. I think it's partly because they really feel, they really see that they're part of something special.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you and Troy decided to do this, was Troy's experience of first seeing Torch Song, was it similar to yours or did he pick out some things that you went like, wait a minute?
No,
Troy.
Very similar. Yeah. And I think he also discovered it through the movie. I think at the time he was obsessed with Anne Bancroft, who played the mom in the
yes.
movies. And I think, and he wasn't out yet when he first saw it.
Okay.
But, so he was even less connected to some of these ideas of like, this is what I might be able to have, you know, but, he also, I think we had a very similar response in terms of like, this is just a story about a guy who's going after what he wants in the world and that he's, you know, it wasn't like the boys in the band where, do you know the boys
yes,
in the band?
Yes,
which is, it's actually a beautifully written play,
it is,
but it is so, they just snipe at each other
yeah.
and they're left at the end in this just, it feels, it is so depressing. You're watching it in the wrong
yeah,
state of mind.
And to me, it's chaotic in a way too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah this yeah. birthday party where they just, there's so much cruelty among this group of men, and there's reasons for that. And the play is aware of those reasons, yeah. But that's not the world. I've been to that birthday party, you know, yeah,
right?
And that's not the world I want to live in.
No.
And I love that Harvey Fierstein is exploring something far more hopeful than yeah. that, and yeah. is allowing his characters to grow.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. We didn't have to play any music or anything because we could keep talking forever. Chris, it's been so wonderful having you here. And let's just let people know one last time
sure.
how they can get tickets.
Sure. Torch Song is playing this weekend. It's our final weekend of Thursday, Friday, Saturday through August 2nd. Tickets are available at www.theateronthetheverge.com. That's theater with an E-R on theverge.com.
Well, Chris, thanks for being here with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Maeve.
And you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 or 92.3 FM. No, 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 said no, no. You're not the one for me. Ooh.
Some outrages are so outrageous that I don't even want to talk about them. But that's when we must speak out. Indeed, let's rage against our government's wholly unprincipled embrace and direct participation in the Israeli government's ongoing massacre of the Palestinian people. Israel's ruthless 2-year invasion of Gaza has already killed 59,000 Palestinian civilians, more than half of them women and children. That's as many killings as our soldiers suffered during the entire Vietnam War. Israel's military has forced nearly all of Gaza's 2 million citizens to abandon their homes and towns, herding them into distant camps, many without food, water, toilets, etc. Excruciating death by starvation, especially among children, is now at epidemic levels in Gaza, creating a dystopian horror. When masses of desperate Palestinians rush to sporadic and inadequate deliveries of humanitarian aid, Israeli snipers and other forces have opened fire on them. Just since May, more than 1,000 unarmed Palestinians have been assassinated in such ambushes. Yes, fiendish Hamas terrorists, who literally operate underground in Gaza, are guilty of sadistic brutality against Israelis. But moral retribution requires going after Hamas, not mounting an inhumane onslaught to wipe the Palestinian people off the earth. This is Jim Hightower saying, a majority of Israelis are now openly rebelling against their government's barbaric abandonment of their people's best values. But what about us? Those sniper bullets and rockets have your and my names on them. Those wasted children who are dying in the agony of starvation belong to us. And it's our politicians who are propping up Israel's corrupt prime minister and war machine. To stop this perversion of our own humanitarian values, go to International Rescue Committee, rescue.org. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
KYRS invites you to get loud in the library, our live concert series in the heart of downtown Spokane. On Saturday, August 2nd at 7 p.m., head up to the third floor of the Spokane Central Library for an unforgettable night of music. This month features Madrona Hollow, an indie folk rock trio known for haunting harmonies, poetic lyrics, and an atmospheric sound that's both intimate and electrifying. Opening the night is Coming Home the Band, a soulful acoustic duo whose bluesy melodies and heartfelt songwriting bring stories of life and love to the stage. This free, all-ages concert is part of our ongoing series presented by KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane Public Library, and Brick West Brewing. Come experience bold sounds on one of the most beautiful stages in Spokane. That's Saturday, August 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Spokane Central Library. Let's get loud in the library. See you there.
And give any day.
This is Flavio.
And Mo, the robot from Mo and Me. You are listening. Robot from Mo and Me. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane.
88.1 and 92.3 FM.